The Calling to Keep the Light Alive was presented by Wes Hurd on December 30, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm just going to provide a little context for what Wes is about to do. We'll let it settle down here for a second. If you're new here this morning, we typically study the scriptures, and our time here is spent in exposition of the Bible. I don't know to what extent Wes will do that this morning, and I just want to provide the context for this. Our last conference at Gutenberg College this past fall was on the mysterious gap that seems to be growing between those of us who are my age and the younger generation coming up, and exploring the way in which technology and our modern culture is affecting and transforming and changing the way younger people actually see the world. So we as the tutors at Gutenberg College, because we work with students generation by generation by generation coming into the classroom with an entirely different mindset, an entirely different perspective on the world than we have, we're very attentive to that and trying to discern what that difference is. Wes and I were in a conversation, and Wes has been doing some reading recently that has stimulated his thought with respect to what's going on in our culture today. And it has led him to some conclusions about what it is that's the unique and special challenge to the Christian faith that exists in the world today that translates in his mind into what it is that's going to be the mission for the church in the age to come. And I just thought it would be, I'm anxious to hear what he's concluded and what he's learned, and so we're going to listen to that this morning. That is the topic, or is this the...
Pretty much, Jax, I appreciate it. This is coming out of the blue. I'm not going to teach from the Bible tonight, today. I hope that what I'm sharing has biblical roots. And I have some nervousness about what I'm going to do this morning for a couple of reasons. One is it's really a kind of patchwork of my thinking over the last 6 or 8 weeks. And the thinking, the patchwork comes from different experiences. And then as I've thought about those experiences, they've sort of somehow landed in the same stew that I've been thinking about. And so my challenge is to communicate the patchwork and hopefully have it hold together like a quilt. But I don't know if I'll be able to pull that off or not. That's the first nervousness. The second nervousness I have is that I hope that I won't come off too academic. I don't want to go there, but part of the core of what I want to share with you has to do with some ideas, some concepts that will, I'm sure for several of you, if not many of you, sound very academic. So for that, I apologize ahead of time, because if I were a better thinker and communicator, I'd be able to conceal it into something not sounding so academic. As Jack said, this came out of a conversation we were having a couple of weeks ago in a social environment. And it came from a conversation that I was having with him as I was pulling the patchwork pieces together, even sort of on the spot. So what am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about part of a dream I had. I'm going to share how that dream connected to some ideas about a visit to New York that I was privileged to make a few weeks ago. I'm going to talk about language a lot. Sort of that's the part that gets academic. So what I'm going to do just for my own interior psychology is I'm going to pretend that we're at the study center, and so I can go there if I need to. So again, I apologize for that if it gets in the way. When I had a chance many years ago to go to seminary for a couple of years and finish, when I finished, I had to write a thesis. And the thesis was coming out of some experiences I was having at the time. The thesis was the social implications of the Great Commission. The Great Commission is that famous set of verses at the end of Matthew where Jesus commissions his disciples to go into the world and baptize and teach men and women everything that he's taught them, to evangelize the world and teach the world regarding the biblical message of the gospel. The social implications, the idea of the Great Commission is normally attached to evangelism, the idea that we want to reach out with the gospel, and it's often quoted in the context of wanting to share the gospel with people and the impetus to wanting to do that, being obedient to Jesus. My thesis was, what are the social implications of that? Are there social implications to that? And at the time, it was interesting because this was back in the 70s. The 60s were still alive, and everybody was wanting to be socially and politically relevant and speak into the world and all that. So I was absorbing all that stuff. And I wanted to write something that connected my desire to want to share the gospel with people to the fact that I believe the Bible also taught that there are social implications of the truth of the gospel. These recent thoughts that I've had are similar in a sense to my conclusion that we have responsibilities, or we have opportunities, as I should say, and in some respects responsibilities to the world as believers, that go beyond the gospel and surround the gospel, not more important than the gospel, but they are things that we, in a sense, in being obedient to loving the world, these are things that we need to be giving some attention to. And the interesting sort of core thought to my conclusions about that and why it's different from my thesis is at the time I was thinking social implications in terms of direct social political action. How do we get involved? How do we become relevant? How do we connect the gospel and being Christian to political activity, social activity? I'm thinking still along those lines as I prepared this, and my concern, I arrived at this conclusion that there's something even more profound, deeper, that we can give the world. That we have the opportunity to give. And in some respects, we have, I think, a responsibility to give. And that is the gift, this is putting it strangely and rather enigmatically at this point, the gift of language. And what I want to share with you this morning is why I think that's true. Now, a little sidebar from this. As I started putting this patchwork together for myself, I wasn't intending to draw conclusions about who are we? What is our, this little community of faith, what is our character? If there is such a thing as an individual calling in the world, And I believe that there's some biblical reason for thinking about that, usually attached to the ideas of gifting in the New Testament, the idea of the gifts. But I think that it's reasonable to talk about a person's calling in the world. Not just the calling to the gospel, but a calling that is a set of opportunities that we have to be in the world in a particular kind of way and to be engaged in the world in a particular kind of way. The question is it possible or is it relevant? Is it even legitimate to think about whether we, as a little collective, as a community of faith, have a calling? I don't know. Maybe not. But the way I'm thinking is just my opinion. My thinking is that probably every little gathering of authentic believers is a collection of a very eclectic group of people who've gotten together for particular reasons, with particular things that they share in common, with an idea of being in the faith together, and that you could more or less characterize that group as having a calling of some sense, that they're this kind of group. And that's kind of what I arrived at and started asking myself the question about us. We're a very eclectic gathering. I mean, if you do a demographic on who's here from Sunday to Sunday and who considers them a part of the community here, it's a very, very eclectic, different gathering of people from just from one end of the spectrum to the other. What hangs us together, what pulls us together, is our deep desire and even commitment to supporting each other in the faith by pursuing what the Bible is saying. What is the Bible really saying? What is the real biblical message? Because the biblical message in the Bible out there in the larger culture, especially in the larger Christian culture, is often a very confusing collection of ideas and thoughts about what's biblical. And we in this community have come to certain conclusions about how we study the Bible and how do we get from the Bible what the Bible really is saying to us. So this community, if nothing else, I mean, what really characterizes us, I think, in some ways, is our desire to want to study the Bible, know what the Bible is really saying, and support each other in that. And I guess, again, the question that I'm playing around with in my mind is there some sense in which at least I would characterize us as having beyond that core calling and that core commitment that we have to wanting to study the Bible, share the Bible, understand the Bible, and apply the Bible to our lives, is there something beyond that? One of the thoughts that came to me came from, and this is my my first patch. I had a dream a number of weeks ago. I woke up. It was one of those dreams. I don't do this very often. I woke up and realized that what I'd been dreaming about is love. I was just left with this very, very strong sense of questioning and trying to mull in my mind what love is. And then I was thinking about it while I was awakened by this thought. I was thinking about God's love and about what love is, and realized, was quite struck in one of those unusual ways, quite struck by how love is indeed the most radical, radical thing in the world. And there's all kinds of arguments that we could go to the Bible and argue that case. But what struck me about it, what struck me about it in its radicality, if you will, was the fact that I can't do what the Bible is calling me to do when it comes to love. That's why it struck me as being so radical. Because try as I might, desire as I might to want to love, I fail so miserably. And I'm talking about a kind of failure in which even those that I'm closest to, the ones that I owe love to because they're so proximate to my life and close to me, even those I don't love the way I should. And as I began to think about that, I realized that in that sense alone, love is so radical. And that's the kind of love that God has given us. That's the kind of love that God loves us with. And that's the kind of love that we should have for one another. And it struck me, the question came up, how do we have an obligation and a responsibility to love the world the way Christ loved the world? Now, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. Maybe you haven't either. But when I let my mind drift to those passages of the New Testament and think that talk about how Jesus, in certain places, Jesus made it so clear that he in some sense loved the world. And John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. So in that sense and in that spirit, that kind of love is radical as well, because I most of the time I'm in reaction against the world, if not being seduced by it. I'm in reaction against it, and I don't have a lot of love for it. God has to change my mentality and my perspective and even my heart condition, in a sense, for me to gather the perspective to want to really love the world. Do we have a calling to love the world in a particular way, to care about each other and love each other, but also do we have an obligation, do we have a spiritual obligation in some sense to love the world? Can we love the world? I think so. And I think God, we can ask God to give us an understanding of that. So the question came up of, and this connecting two patches here, one of them being this love and this interest to want to engage with the world. Can we make a difference in the world? Is there something that we can give the world? Is there a way that we can love the world? And does this church, does this fellowship, does this community of faith have a calling? And I'm pulling those things together. And I think the answer is yes. What kind of a world is it that we are called to love? This connects back with the topic and the problem, the challenge, if you will, that Jack was referring to when he introduced me. What is the condition of the world that we're supposed to love? I think we live in a world that believes and feels the impact of a present and growing great intellectual and spiritual darkness. This world believes and is trying to come to terms with and has embraced and is trying to come to terms with what seems to be a very dark and closed future. I talked a little bit about this in my thoughts at Oktoberfest. And this closed and depressing future is a consequence of a series of perceived and real cultural failures. The world has been through a series of shocking historical unfoldings from the time of the Enlightenment, where there was a great dream of human progress, of human perfection, that technology and the human mind and reason was going to be able to project a new, bright, enlightened world to live in. And since that time, over the last couple of hundred years, and especially in the 20th century, that world has dissipated. It has fallen apart. It has exploded. And it has left most people in the world bewildered and feeling very unhopeful about the future. And this perception that the world has of very real cultural failures touch on the very core, I think, of our deepest intuitions about what it means to be human. As we wrestle with ourselves, who are we? What does it mean to be a human being? And we look at the context of the world and recent world history, and we sense we are overcome by the sense of darkness and failure and hopelessness. Just a quick summary of the contributing streams that have gone into this. One is that philosophy, the endeavor and work of philosophy that began literally thousands of years ago, has culminated in the 20th and early 21st century with great failure. Thousands of years of philosophy and philosophical work have resulted in no commonly or widely held conviction that philosophy itself can provide adequate, reliable answers to man's core questions. Philosophical endeavor, working in philosophy and trying to figure out the world and make sense of the world, can at best clarify certain issues. It can point out things that are false, but it hasn't really provided, and I'm saying this is how the world, I sense this is how the world is thinking. This is how the world is feeling about itself and about the condition of history. But it cannot provide universally accepted answers to personal, social, political problems, the crises that are present and growing in the world. What about science and technology? Well, here we have kind of a mixed bag. I think the world looks at science and technology on the one hand, at least many in the world, and say, well, that's our hope. Science provides us with stunning technical power. And based on the possibilities and the potential of that power, we should have hope that science can provide the answers. But again, 150 or more years of the unfolding of increasingly powerful and effective scientific prowess and power has not resulted in a better world. It's a more complicated world. It's a more complex world. And in many ways, it's a more destructive world. It has more potent, more potentiality for destroying itself with science than it ever had. So science is kind of a mixed bag, but it doesn't leave, in general, people aren't looking to science for the answers. We've been through the experience in the 20th century of putting a man on the moon, but we've also been through wars and conflicts in which the science and technology have been used in ways that are cataclysmic and awesomely disturbing. What about religion? Is the world looking to religion? It's a mixed bag, again. I think that most of the what I would call the educated, cultured world today equates religion with zealous, irrational, society-splitting effects. On the one hand, they would tip their hat and say religion can provide us with hope. That is, that if God exists, if there's a transcendent power above us that we can look to, perhaps there are some answers there that we haven't seen, but we don't see much evidence of it in human history, they would say. Religion can also provide, it can function for us. Religion can function for us by providing a kind of ennobling of mankind, identifying mankind with a transcendent maker or a transcendent source, and provide reasons for moral and ethical rules and boundaries. So religion can function for us in some very useful ways, but religion, as to its truthfulness, as to whether it's actually true or not, the world would say, well, who knows about that? That's an unanswerable question. And in general, to conclude, the world would look at the existence of fundamentalisms in the world. Christian fundamentalism, Islamic various kinds of Islamic fundamentalisms, they look at those kinds of conservative expressions of religion and they would say those are destructive entities in the world. Those are destructive forces in the world. Religion is not helpful at all in this world. What we need to be doing is building a world that's unified, not a world that's broken down and split up and conflict over religious differences. So again, they would give a mixed result there. All of this, science and technology, religion and philosophy, have in some respects performed as the authorities in this world for us historically. They have been what we have looked to as an authority. Who do we look to for answers? What do we look to provide hope for the future? And these entities have been that hope in many respects. And now they're in deep question. There's a great spiritual and intellectual malaise, a darkness out there that the world is struggling with. It's in denial about it, maybe much of the time. We entertain ourselves to death, but it's there. And most people would admit to that. So the world that we're to love, the world that we're living in, is a very difficult, complex world. How can we love that world? How can we care about it? How can we not only build ourselves up in the faith, understand what the Bible's saying, but also how can we love the world with this radical thing called love? Hold that question. Another piece of the patchwork. About 6 weeks ago, I had the privilege and opportunity to visit an artist friend of mine in New York City. His name is Mako Fujimura. He and his wife started an organization about 15 years ago, just the two of them, called IAM, International Arts Movement. Mako is a working artist. He's a successful artist. He is Japanese. He is raised in American culture, spent 6 years studying in Japan and doing the Japanese equivalent of a PhD in his field of art. But he started this organization many years ago, and recently there's been this spurt of growth in this organization. And I've been in touch with Mako over the last 6 years. We visited and met them about 2 months before the great 01 disaster, 9/11. And Mako and I hit it off right away. And I was staying in touch with him about what his endeavors to want to bring Christianity and his faith into the world and to mentor and disciple with regard to issues of faith and art. So I went to visit. As it turns out, that I've known this for some time. I wrote a paper, an essay, 5 or 6 years ago, and delivered it at an Oktoberfest. The paper was titled "The Critical Zone: Speculations on a Conceptual Space for Postmodern Seekers." And it's basically a thesis that argues that where we normally think of the world as being on one hand, here's the world, and then here's the kingdom of God. Here's the world. Here are believers. Believers are over here in the church, and non-believers are out here in the world. I was arguing that because of the conditions of postmodernity, that there is a sense in which both Christians and non-Christians who believe that truth is available, that truth can be found, real truth can be, should be sought. And sometimes on the Christian side of it, Christian truth doesn't always look like what the church says it is. And on the world side of it, the truth has been given up on. And so people in the world who are still pursuing truth are alienated in their world. And there's a certain sense in which Christians in the church culture, in Christian culture are alienated because they're really interested in truth that doesn't always have pietistic trimmings all over it. And so in both cases, worldlings and believers end up in this space between the church and the world, looking for truth, wanting to know the truth, and somewhat marginalized by their various communities. Well, Mako took that paper, he read it, and he really liked it, and he thought it was helpful for his organization, and they've been using it. IM has been using it to sort of map their plans for their organization, which is, again, centered in New York. What was interesting when I went to New York was I found out, yeah, they were really serious about that. That kind of blew me away from their board of directors and their staff. They were actually using that idea to help them think about what they were doing with their arts organization. And the second thing, and this is the relevant part, was from top to bottom, in talking with Mako, spending several hours with him, from top to bottom, their board of trustees, their board of directors, and all their working staff, of which there are, I think, maybe 5 or 6 or 7, and then a bunch of volunteers, all of them are Christians. All of them would absolutely prioritize wanting to share the gospel with someone. That's the number one priority if they had a chance. But the organization IAM is a secular, if you will, a not a religious organization. It is an organization that is simply there. Its mission is to produce, how do I put this? The mission is to be culturally productive. That is, they want to put art into the world that comes out of Christians and non-Christians whose art is still keeping alive the question of what does it mean to be human? Truth can be found. In other words, a positive cultural production. Now, what's the significance of that? The significance is, for me personally, is I've never met a group of Christians who, from top to bottom, have a deep desire and motive to want to share the gospel with people and have a Christian mission, who have prioritized as their working model this idea of wanting to simply produce culture. And then if they get the opportunity to share the gospel, they will do that. They will share the gospel. They will mentor and disciple and encourage young, emerging Christian artists. But their mission is to engage with the world in a way that produces positive, in a sense, useful, thoughtful, cultural, in this case, art artifacts, art objects and art thinking, from theater to dance to visual art to music. And that caught me. It struck me because as I think about who we are as a community, as I think about the endeavors that we've had with Gutenberg, I think that there's some interesting territory to, even as a church, as a fellowship, and the support that you give to the overall ministry that we all have, as a church, as a college, as a study center, as an arts art project organization. Is there a sense in which we have the opportunity to produce culture? And I want to pick this up in a second. And my answer to that is yes. And I think that's a part. It's a part of the possibility of the calling that we all may be sharing in. Okay. Now we get to the academic part. So hang with me here, and again, I apologize if this gets a little bit thick. Another patch. I've been reading this literary critic, stumbled onto his work a couple of years ago. His name is George Steiner. And the first reading that I did was a book called Real Presences. The second book was one that I actually, an earlier book that he did the T.S. Eliot lectures in 1970. In these T.S. Eliot lectures, he points out that he believes that Western culture is in the late afternoon, that the sun is going down on Western civilization. Now, Mr. Steiner is not, he's Jewish, but he's not an Orthodox Jew. He's not a conservative Jew. He's Jewish culturally. He was raised in Paris by German parents, and he was raised trilingually, so he speaks fluently in German, English, and French, and writes literary criticism in all those languages. He's a very amazing character. But he basically argues that the languages in which our culture, its soul and its mind are written, that those languages are dying. That the Western mind is exhausted. His great concern is that if languages, if what he's calling the languages die, the future dies. And the future depends on our being able to conceive of a future worth living in, a future that we can both build and maintain. Now, there's a certain sense in which the events of the 20th century have killed the future. And therefore, the motive for using languages the way we have historically used them to think with, those languages are dying because we don't really see a future. And then as the languages shrink, Steiner argues, we don't have the language possibilities, the potential of languages to be able to think about the future. So it's kind of this circular dark hole. And again, here's my question, part of my patchwork here. Do we have an opportunity? Can we ask, do we have a spiritual and moral responsibility to the future of this world? I think we'd say yes. Perhaps it's sort of like, given the darkness of the world and given the thesis that I'm starting to explain with Steiner about the use of languages and how they are what we use to think with. Perhaps it's like, to put it simply, it's like that cup of cold water that we give in Jesus' name to the world. The world is thirsty. The world is dying. The light is dimming. And can we give? Can we love the world in that way? And what would we give? Perhaps it would be like Paul at the Areopagus in Athens, where we have a very concise, truncated text that tells us what he was doing when he had the opportunity to preach to the Greeks, to the Gentiles in Athens, to the intellectuals there and to that culture. He spent a lot of time tilling the soil in order to establish some common ground. Well, maybe there's a lot of soil tilling that needs to be done. Maybe there's some cultural production that needs to be done. Maybe part of what we're about is loving the world by tilling the soil, by keeping something alive. We won't go into that any further. So Steiner's argument is that language makes this thought and discourse and conversation of the future possible. Conceiving or thinking of a future can only be done by looking at the past. That's all we have to work with. The tools and equipping that we get to be able to think about ourselves, think about the world, think about a possible future, come from history. We use our acquisition of language to examine human history. Why? Because we have to. We have no other place to go. As Steiner puts it, Steiner puts it this way, he says, because a society that seeks to create its own vision of life, that's the vision of life is my term, is trying to determine determine what he calls the reach, the logic, and the authority of its own voice. The reach, the logic, and the authority of its own voice, the culture's voice. So it's looking at itself, and examining its own process of how it deals with the truth. It must do so from looking to and coming to terms with the weight and reality of its own past, and the powers and character of its recent and remote history. So we mine history in order to be able to think about who we are, where we are, and where we might be going, and what the possibility of a future is. What do I mean by a vision of life? A vision of life is a large sort of holistic picture of what does it mean to be human? Who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? What is our hope? That's the whole collection of all the big questions, a vision of what it means to be alive, to have life. And it's a hopeful vision and has historically been what I would mean by a vision of life would be it's that vision of ourselves and who we are as human beings and culture in the world that gives us a desire to live a life that's worth living. So Steiner also points out, and a lot of this is common sense stuff, but he says we are also creatures whose inherent habit, if you want to put it, our default behavior, revolves around meaning. How do we get meaning? How do we make sense of ourselves? Meaning is a part of that vision of life. So we determine the answers to these questions, he argues, in the only way we can, by looking to and examining the past, what has happened through history and the history of ideas. And this history comes to us in language. He argues that we make sense of our existence by access to pictures, images, languages that make it possible for us to have a conceptual vocabulary. Sorry for the 50-cent words. We have to have a conceptual vocabulary in order to be able to think. The bigger the conceptual vocabulary, the more broadly and deeply and more penetratingly we can think. Now, around here, we don't have a lot of problem with thinking and faith. But there, in Christian history, and in recent American Christian history, there's been a great problem with the idea of putting together thinking with faith. But thinking, we would argue here, I think, is very much a part of faith. And languages are what we think with. As in a sense, math. In math, you have to have numbers and letters and symbols, right? In order to do math, you have to have words, syntax, and what I'm going to talk about in a minute, grammar, in order to think. So meaning comes to us through language. And language gives us then, in that sense, gives us the opportunity or the means of understanding, interpreting our present through looking at the past, examining what we've inherited in our vocabulary and our language, in order to conceive of and have some sense of hope for existence in a future. Meaning comes to us through language, and also, interestingly, Steiner argues that we have what he calls a grammar. Now, I'm going to actually quote this little sentence of his, and then I'll try to explain it. I think it may be self-explanatory. What is a grammar? Well, it's the rules of a language, how you use the words, so everybody can communicate. He argues that a grammar, it can be thought of as being bigger than that. A grammar is the articulate organization. Grammar is the articulate organization of perception, receiving, reflection, thinking and processing, and experience. That is when we engage back with the world. So when we receive information, we receive thinking and history and ideas and language from the world, then we use those to think about and organize our thoughts, and then to engage and to be in the world through our experience. And he's saying that what he's calling a grammar, if you will, is all those things. It's the means by which we engage, we receive, think, and then re-engage with the world. Perceive, thinking, and then engaging with the world. He's calling that a grammar. I'm attracted to this idea because there's a certain sense in which what he's saying is very similar to and would overlap with what we mean by a worldview. What is a worldview? A worldview is a set of beliefs that someone has that forms the foundation for how they form values and ethics and determine answers to the big questions. What's real? Is God there? What is man? What is human history? What does death mean? Those kinds of questions. We have a worldview will help you, has sort of answers to those kinds of questions for people. Well, what he's saying about a grammar is, what I like about it, is it's basically a worldview in a sense, but he's attaching the notion of language to it. What he means by that is that our worldviews are, if we examine a little bit deeper, our worldviews are made possible by language, by grammar. So, a grammar implies a language-based character, the language-based character of a worldview, that it's constructed of language. Our freedom and the tools we seek, that we need to acquire and determine meaning, are related intrinsically to our acquisition of language and grammar. In some ways, so fundamental, and I'm hoping I'm not getting you lost on this. But what has struck me about this is that it's these kinds of things that we as a community are very comfortable with. We have among us people who are gifted and who have personal callings that have a great deal to do with these issues. How does this language stuff work? What am I saying? When I read or hear an idea or a thought that explains the world or part of it, it feeds and gives energy to my desire to understand. If I, through my own vocabulary and language and the own bit of grammar, the grammar that makes my thinking work that I use all the time, if that gives me a bit of understanding about the world, it affects me. It gives me a certain sense of, oh, I can know. I can construct something. I can understand. I can understand more than I do now. And that feels pretty good. I can actually understand and expand my own self, my own abilities in the world, and under the gospel, it gives me greater understanding of how I can grasp the gospel itself and the implications of the gospel in my life and in the world. It's an interesting thing that Steiner also defines what is class, what he calls classic. You know, we in our community we rub shoulders a lot with the notion of Gutenberg providing something of a classical education. It's not a pure classical education. We do a little Greek. We read a few Greeks and Romans. But we have to do with a lot of homeschooling families who are very interested in classical education. What does that mean? Steiner argues that what he means by classic in literature, music, and the arts, and in philosophical argument, the classic for him means it is those ideas, that content, and the means of that content, the grammar, if you will, that allows us to keep alive the questioning of what does it mean to be a human being? What is good? What is just? What is evil? What does a good human life look like? What we call classic, the reason we read the classics is because whether it be in philosophy, in literature, in poetry, in the arts, something that's classic by Steiner's definition is that which enables and keeps on enabling a human being to ask the deepest questions that need to be asked. So he says that I define classic in literature, music, and the arts, and in philosophical argument as, and it gets a little weedy right here, hang with me, as a signifying form, that is, what he means by that is philosophy, art, or literature, a form that reads us. What does he mean by that? It reads us more than we read it. Each time we engage with it, the classic will question us. It will challenge our resources of consciousness and mind. The classic will ask of us, have you understood? Have you reimagined responsibility? Are you prepared to act on the questions, upon the potentialities of transformed, enriched being, which I, the classic, have posed to you? I like that definition because it doesn't attach it necessarily to one particular language or form or culture. It attaches it to some fundamental ethical and moral and philosophical powers that undergird what a classic piece of literature accomplishes for us, that it penetrates us. So, that's pretty much the last patch. Love, concern about the world, can we love the world? How do we love the world? Language, do we have a calling? Us, somehow, some way, loose calling? We study the Bible, and we're going to continue to study the Bible. It is, in a sense, for all of us, priority number one, to understand the truth. We are also a community, Reformation Fellowship, Gutenberg College, Mackenzie Study Center, Art Project. We're a community. We're a gathering of people doing different kinds of things at different times. But it seems to me that in general, our community traffics. We commerce in ideas. And if you will, in the terms that I've been talking about this morning, in language and grammar. What does Gutenberg do? What does Gutenberg provide? What is its mission? Of course, it's to teach the gospel. Of course, it's to have a mission, a spiritual mission. But part of that spiritual mission, I would argue, is that we are providing the language and the sense of a grammar that allow our students, when they choose to engage, meaningfully with the world and with themselves. I think that there has been a sentiment among the tutors, the staff, and the teachers have been around for a long time, that whereas we might have hoped that Gutenberg's education would provide more students who are directly interested in studying the Bible seriously, and you know, I think all of us would say we have a mixed result on that. But what we have done is we've provided the language and the grammar to look at history, to look at ourselves. We've provided an expanded vocabulary for people that keeps alive the vocabulary and the language and the grammar that keeps alive. And it's our little drop in the ocean of wanting to love the world and give to our students and to the world the opportunity to see if there's light in the world, to see if there's still the possibility of light. A lot of what Gutenberg does is, if you want to put it in these terms, is sort of pre-gospel, as it tills the soil. It provides the languages, it provides the grammar, and it provides, hopefully, some modeling of how to think about ourselves and the world and how to engage with the world. Is this an easy calling? No. No. It's really tricky. And in many ways, all of us, all the tutors certainly would line up from Gutenberg and say, well, we're just kind of learning as we go. It's tricky. I think that showed up a bit in our recent topic at Oktoberfest, where we're talking about the issues that come from one generation going through a whole different set of cultural conditions than a previous generation, and their responses and engagement with those questions that come out of that, those experiences have been quite different, the conclusions they've come to. So it's tricky. But it seems to me that in the same sense that the organization I Am, this IAM organization, where they are being culture producers, it is they're tilling the soil, they're putting things out there in the world that enable the questions to stay alive rather than to disappear. That's a really important and important cultural task. It's a way for us to love the world, if you will. I want to close with this, and I'll have maybe a few minutes to interact if you have a few questions or responses to what I'm saying. You all have come across the Dylan Thomas, the most famous Dylan Thomas poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. That poem was written in a completely different spirit than the way I'm going to appropriate the last couple of lines. But I've decided to steal them and reload them for my closing thought. It seems to me those lines are, do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. It seems to me that we can rage against the dying of the light. In the sense that, not in the way that Dylan Thomas intended this for his father, but in a sense that we can rage against the darkness that's settling down, and that it's a godly and good thing to do. It's what Jesus would have us do, fight against the darkness. And we're doing it, I think this community is doing it at a most fundamental level, and we need to keep doing it. I don't know how God's going to keep that going, but I just think we do need to keep it going. And it's a great way for us to care about the world. Thanks. If you want to interact with me a little bit, that'd be great.
Thanks, Wes. Hey, it seems like our desire for understanding is this God-given, to make sense of the world and to make sense of ourselves, is something that just goes. It's wired. But it does seem like it can be quenched, inhibited, kept away. I mean, am I right? Does that sound?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of current generations coming up who still have this desire for understanding. But it seems like what is changing and going away, if I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying, are the tools by which we can understand the world.
And the hope of the use of those tools, that using the tools is going to get us anywhere.
Say that again.
We're losing the tools, but part of the reason we're losing the equipping of the language and the grammars and all that is because we've been through a century of experiences in which having the tools hasn't really gotten us anywhere in a sense. You have to have, I think, a transcendent incentive to believe that the tools actually work and that they're going to take you somewhere and they're going to be productive. And we've given up on that transcendent perspective.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, one of the things that really hit me in this Summer Institute at Gutenberg was Kierkegaard's emphasis on objectively having an objective perspective of our own subjectivity.
Right.
And I'm hearing that kind of as well in terms of what you're saying. But what we're losing is that culture that encourages the penetration that you spoke of that allows us to inspect ourselves and understand ourselves and the world we live in.
Yeah.
Could you then, and this portion of my question is meant to put you completely out of contention for the Vernon Grounds, is to bring the full circle in terms of how technology might inhibit those tools, the emphasis of technology in our culture, how that might short-circuit and actually encourage us to suppress that natural appetite for understanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I heard a lecture at the university a month and a half ago or so by a woman who I'm not sure if she's based at Harvard or somewhere. She was talking about the impact of, MIT. Sorry. Oh, sorry, Dale. Let's get this right. that technology, the language of technology and computer and robotics tends to shrink language down and also create narrowing means of communication. That is, we don't need an expanded vocabulary. We just use these sound bites and bits. And when that's a kind of shrinking that's happening as technology and the digital world emerges and the image, visual image world also is having that kind of impact, that it's having that kind of shrinking effect and impact on language. So one of the questions that I have, and I've mentioned this to a couple of people, is that if the classic, what Sanger calls the classic, is actually something more fundamental than just a specific book or set of literature or a canon of books from... If the classic is something that we could describe as being a power and a motivation and then that goes into a content that keeps asking questions and keeps the vocabulary expanded, if not expanding it, at least maintains it, can that happen in the question that you're asking? Can we do that in a sense in the digital world? It seems to be coming. I think that's a great question. Theoretically, I'd like to think yes, but how? I think that would be an interesting project. How do we translate the classic, the innocent, the great books, how do we translate it into the new languages that are emerging, that are connected to science and technology or to the digital world, the world of images? Interesting question.
Two issues regarding that issue of technology in my mind that come to mind quickly. One is, it seems like technology has become another drug to numb people's ideas so that they don't even think anymore, or don't need to think. They're entertained. It's another form of entertainment, and that, at least that end of the technology aspect that keeps growing and that we become more and more intrigued with, so that we just sit in front of it all day and don't interact with our minds. It's just given to us. And related to that is the idea that technology and the visual side of things, everything is nowadays is prepackaged. We're given what to think. We're given the images. We're given the ideas and concepts so that we don't need to think anymore about, you know, at least with literature, you have to use your mind and develop your ideas and concepts of what things look like and how people are interacting. With the visuals given to us so much in movies and computers and YouTube and all that kind of stuff, everything is set in our minds through those technologies, and we don't learn how to think anymore. It's just given. Mm-hmm. So you've almost got this elite group of people, whether they be the directors and producers of all these things. They're the ones who are doing some of the thinking, but the rest of us are just receptors for those things.
Yeah, it does seem to me, this is a question that I haven't explored, and it seems to me that the reading I have done is that we have to have language to think with. That just seems to be wired with us, the human condition and the human character and nature. So one guy who I was reading who's actually in favor of and actually excited about the fact that images may be replacing words, even he was admitting that we'll never get rid of words. Words seem to be what we use. So
I just wanted to ask a question. You said the author was Steiner. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? So first of all, thank you. Mm. It was really, really wonderful. As you were talking about language, I just found it so intriguing in Western culture that the exhaustion, you know, automatically you think, oh, overuse, so there's an exhaustion. But it's almost, the thing that came to my mind was almost an exhaustion from atrophy, mm-hmm. of lack of use, mm-hmm. and that our false arrogance of Western culture and the smallness of it, that the input and output of language and grammar has possibly become so small that that's leading to the exhaustion, and it's not from expanding. And that's what's so exciting right now. And I think of Gutenberg and our church, but even more than that, because there's so many people in here that our lives are in other areas, that what's our calling, mm-hmm. and are we being small in our input and output because of fear or... Anyway, it was just really a good way to start the new year.
Thank you.
I wanted to thank you.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to quit. The time the children are waiting. I'd be glad to hang around up here if you want to talk a little bit. Thank you.